is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Yes, listeners do support this program, and I'm very grateful. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount or a monthly deduction via PayPal of the amount of your choosing as low as $5. My thanks to Nancy from Winters, California, a stalwart supporter of this program. On today's program, we'll lead off with a look at the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians, such as it is. Dr. Jeff Halper, an Israeli Jew, will join us in a moment. Also on today's program, one of my recent heroes, Dr. Margaret Flower. She got arrested trying to get Max Baucus to talk about single-payer health care. She's on the road with the mad-as-hell doctors. We'll check in with her in a few minutes. And I've got some scary statistics about the increases in health insurance. It'll just underscore the need for real reform, which we're probably not going to get. And to round out this podcast program, Gary Chu, our official movie reviewer, is going to tell you about the new Matt Damon movie, The Informant. That's all ahead today here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Our lead story today regards the continuing conflict between the Palestinians and Israel and the blockade of Gaza. Dr. Jeff Halper is an Israeli. He's a Jew, and he is the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's been on our program in the past. Jeff Halper, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were here in the Bay Area last year, and you came on my program. You gave a talk at the Presbyterian Church in San Anselmo. And I was very impressed with your commitment to peace and the work that you've been doing. And I'd like to first get your reaction to the United Nations report that was published here in mid-September regarding the Israeli attack on Gaza that took place around Christmas time last year and continued, it was about 27 days, on into January. And there was quite a bit of destruction. A lot of civilians were killed. As I recall, the body count was about 1,400 Palestinians and 13, no zeros behind it, 13 Israelis. Three of those were civilians. The rest were soldiers.
Right.
And the report, which was chaired by Richard Goldstone, a judge from South Africa, is stunning in the way it recounts what I consider to be atrocities by Israel. And he and his colleagues describe them as potential war crimes. Tell me your thoughts about the UN report and if it will have any impact.
Well, it might. I mean, the report really adds very little that's new. You know, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, many human rights organizations have already documented in detail the war crimes that were committed by Israel. But you know, this is an official report. I mean, this is a UN report that can then be taken to the International Criminal Court, which is a court in which you can now try war criminals. It's the court that Israel, the United States, and China refused to participate with. So there's a question there about some of the procedural details. But essentially, it makes it much more easy to begin to bring Israel before international courts and be held accountable for its actions.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, I think it's something that's very serious.
But let me offer you the way this was published in the San Francisco Chronicle, because the report is 575 pages. It details more than 30 different incidents of Israeli, to put it kindly, overreaction. And it does make some references to potential war crimes by the Palestinians, but those are limited to the use of rockets that were aimed into southern Israel from Gaza. And that is a known issue that is decried by those of us in the West who support the aspirations of the Palestinian people. And despite that imbalance, the headline reads, UN probe finds Gaza war crimes by both sides. Now, people who only read the headline, Jeff, are going to come away saying, oh, I guess Israel's not so bad, because the UN report, according to this Associated Press headline, says that there were war crimes on both sides.
No, that's true. There's a false symmetry here. You know, we always talk about the false symmetry between Israel, which is the strong party and the occupying power, and the Palestinians that are resisting. So there is that that problem with that. I mean, it is true that under human rights, you're not allowed to attack civilian targets. So from that point of view, shooting rockets into civilian areas of Israel was also something that shouldn't have been done, and it's appropriate, I think, that it was condemned. But, I mean, you're right. It sets up a kind of a false symmetry between the sides. What's funny about it is that Israel's very upset with that because Israel doesn't want any symmetry. Israel wants to be seen as the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinians should be the only ones to be condemned. So at the same time that many of us feel it's not fair to the Palestinians that their resistance is equated with the Israeli invasion and occupation, at the same time, Israel feels aggrieved that it's that it's being portrayed as the perpetrator and not as the victim. So the sword cuts both ways.
Well,
I think one of the points is this issue though of disproportionality, because that's the key to the international law. In other words, that Israel might have even had a right to respond. You know, after all, rockets were fired into its territory. But the response was so disproportionate to the threat that's what made it a war crime. In other words, it was a qualitatively different from the Palestinian attacks. They both shouldn't have been done. But I think the report, it's true, you have to read it and so on,
mm-hmm.
but the report certainly puts more blame on Israel than on the Palestinians.
Well, and Jeff, I share your use of this terminology here of false symmetry, because I'm not for a moment rationalizing attacks by Hamas or even independent individuals against Israeli civilians. But we do have to look at the way Israel created a phony provocation that occurred on our election day when the U.S. was not paying attention to issues in the Middle East. And it led to this unilateral military assault that was so disproportionate. And it included a number of atrocities, in my view, including the events at the Al-Quds Hospital, where there was a direct and intentional attack, using the language of the report, on the hospital and an ambulance depot there in Gaza City. There is the incident where Israeli soldiers encouraged Palestinians to take refuge in a building, and then they proceeded to attack that building. And 15 people were killed in that event. There is the attack in the Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City, where they got Palestinians to assemble and then attacked a specific location. We know that bulldozers were used as weapons as they destroyed olive groves that are the source of sustenance and export for the limited trade that occurs from Palestine. And so, again, if we look at this on balance, this headline is grossly misleading to say that they found war crimes equivalent by both sides.
No, that's true. No, that's true. I mean, they had no choice, in a sense. They couldn't have ignored what the Palestinians did. But, I mean, that's true. The other thing we have to keep in, you know, you mentioned this phony attack. The other thing we have to keep in mind is Bush, because this was done, in a sense, in collaboration with Bush and Condoleezza Rice, because these were in the very last days of the Bush administration, and it was an attempt to create a fait accompli before Obama came into office. The idea being that to break Hamas, maybe the Fatah could come back in and retake Gaza, and in a sense to pacify Gaza, just as Israel had pacified the West Bank, so when Obama came in, there wouldn't have to be any more negotiations. Israel, in a sense, could present him with a pacified Palestine on a silver platter, and then they could have just signed some fake peace agreement, and it's over. The Israeli occupation becomes a permanent political fact. The fact is, however, that the Palestinians held on. That's one of the amazing things. In other words, the vaunted Israeli army was not able to really penetrate very far. It did terrible things, especially from the air and with artillery. But in fact, Israel was not able to take Gaza in 22 days, even though it beat the entire Arab world in the Six-Day War.
Mm-hmm.
So, it says something. I mean, it's a crime that it happened, and certainly the Palestinian suffering is a terrible crime as well. But at the same time, the Palestinians resisted Israel, and I think, that's something that's very important, because it means that Israel and the United States together cannot impose a peace, that the Palestinians have the will and the ability to resist, and so at the end of the day, there's got to be a negotiated solution.
Jeff Halper, what is your sense here 9 months into the Bush, the Obama administration? That was an interesting slip.
Right.
9 months into this new administration, do you see prospects for peace? Do you feel that the appointment of George Mitchell as a special envoy to Israel and Palestine is making a difference? What's your current assessment?
Mm-hmm. Well, I sound fairly optimistic. I mean, Mitchell's a very serious person. That and the fact it was him and not Dennis Ross already gave a lot of credibility to Obama. And the very fact that Obama said the magic words, he said the resolving the Palestine issue is in the vital national interest of the United States. That, I think, put the whole conflict on a different level. Now you're really talking about vital American interests, which means that the United States would have the will to assert its policies in terms of Israel and on Israel. And that was a very good thing. It started out well. But then, for some reason, since the Cairo talk, the United States has started to go back to haggling with Israel. You know, this settlement, that settlement, partial settlement, freeze, maybe, which I don't understand. And Mitchell is today met with Netanyahu. And I don't know what happened. I haven't heard the news yet.
Well, I can update you on that in a moment.
United States is not going to get a settlement freeze.
Well, here is the report from Jerusalem. This is Dateline September 16th. Washington Special Envoy to the Mideast Wednesday wrapped up his second meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu without reaching an agreement on curtailing Israeli settlement construction.
Yeah.
Mitchell
yeah.
said he'll sit down on Friday for a third time with Netanyahu. They are scrambling here because next week the U.S. is trying to broker a meeting around the U.N.'s annual meetings and the president's speech there to try to move forward and try to get a meeting between Abu Mazen, that's Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, and Mr. Netanyahu. But I think this is quite an irritant on the part of Israel to provocatively announce that it is expanding settlements
and
poking the eye, in my view, of both the United States and the Palestinians at a time when they could be sending much more conciliatory signals.
Well, and I don't really understand it. I mean, the United States is being humiliated. Here, I mean, what does it mean that Mitchell has to go and beg Netanyahu in Jerusalem? I mean, Netanyahu should be called on the carpet to Washington. He should go sit in the American consulate in Des Moines, Iowa somewhere and have some third-rate State Department person talk with him. The very idea that the president's envoy has to come to Israel and cool his heels and beg Israel, you know, when Israel is a client state, it's gotten $100 billion over the years from the United States. You know, it's something that I really don't understand. The United States is absolutely humiliating itself in front of Israel, and the message is that Israel calls the shots. So the whole thing is very strange, and the fact that Mitchell is willing to come sit at Netanyahu's doorstep for 3-4 days, you know, for a country the size of New Jersey, is a very strange thing. There's something wrong, I think, in American politics if this is what's happening. I mean, Israel is spitting in the face of the United States, and it doesn't seem to matter to Americans.
Well, Jeff Halper, let me offer you one viewpoint. I get regular emails from a gentleman named Ted Bellman in Jerusalem. His website is called Israel Pundit. And I think here, in a very candid way, he describes his assessment of the politics of settlement expansion. And he goes through some interesting history going back to the U.S. Essentially turning a blind eye to Israeli expansions at certain times over the years. And then he focuses in on the current picture. He says, fact, President Obama has been transformed from a coattail president to an anchor chain president, taking a dive from a 65% approval rating in January to less than 50% in September. Thus, Democratic House candidates and members... I agree, but this is his argument. He says, thus, Democratic House candidates and members are experiencing the lowest ebb in 2 years, while Republicans enjoy a systematic edge. Obama is confronted by an effective blue dog Democratic opposition. So what he is saying here, and let me read this next paragraph, he also calls it a fact. Obama exercises psychological pressure against Israel. He cannot exert an effective tangible pressure. He wasn't elected to uproot Jewish settlements and prevent Jewish construction in Jerusalem. His political future and that of Democrats does not depend on these issues. The Arab-Israeli conflict is not among Obama's top priorities, and his position on Israel is not compatible with most Democrats. Obama needs the support of Israel's friends on Capitol Hill in order to advance his primary domestic and national security international agendas. Now, Jeff, what I read between the lines here in Ted Bellman's commentary is he's saying that AIPAC has Capitol Hill wrapped around its pinky finger and that Obama doesn't dare take on the incredible influence that AIPAC has, particularly on Democratic members of the House and Senate.
I mean, that's true. I mean, first of all, he's wrong in that it's not a key issue for Obama. I think Obama understands that unless he deals with the Palestine issue, the United States is not going to get out of Iraq. You're not going to stabilize the entire Muslim world and have reconciliation with it. So I think it's a very high priority. But what's true is, you know, there's the American saying that all politics are local. So that the Democratic Party has always been more pro-Israel than the Republicans. And when I was in Washington, the word was that Obama's going to have more trouble with Nancy Pelosi than he's going to have with Netanyahu. And this is the issue. Can Obama take control of his own party on this very difficult issue? And I think the fact that he's gotten a kind of beaten up over health care is not a good sign for the Palestinian issue, because you know, even if he scrapes through the health care issue and manages even to bring the blue dog Democrats with him to bring up now another issue that the Democrats have never supported, which is a just peace between Israel and Palestine and pressures on Israel, is something that I don't know if he could do. And I think that's where Netanyahu, in a sense, he thinks that that's true, that Obama will not muster the clout in Congress, and therefore if he hangs tough Netanyahu, that he can win. So really it's a matter of internal American politics. Can Obama, who understands that this conflict has to be resolved for American interests, convince the Democratic Party and the Jewish lobby behind it that, in fact, this is where the United States has to go? That's really the imponderable today. I don't know exactly where we're going with this.
Yeah. And I'd like to see more even-handedness on the part of Democratic leaders, even those who are cozy with AIPAC, to really put some discipline into this and not simply keep, brushing off the aggressive actions of Israel. Because if we are going to move forward, there's a new blueprint that we'll talk about here in a moment, but if we're going to move forward, it is going to take restraint on the part of Israel. And to date, we're not seeing that from the Netanyahu government.
There will never be restraint from Israel. Either it's going to be imposed on Israel, or Israel is going to get its way. Israel is not going to cooperate. And I think your job, actually, in San Francisco is to rein in Nancy Pelosi. Because this is one of the greatest obstacles, I think, to making peace in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've known Nancy Pelosi for a long time, and one of the things I have the least respect for her on is the approach to Israel and her closeness with AIPAC. And we saw in 2006, after the Democrats regained control, there was discussion about inserting in one of the supplemental bills a ban on any attack on Iran. And after the parade of Democratic leaders to the AIPAC conference, all of a sudden, that clause was removed, and that was clearly at the behest of the Israeli government at that time.
Yeah, and that's really the issue, because this is going to be resolved, I think, behind closed doors within the Democratic Party, and we'll see what happens. But again, I think the fact that he's had trouble with health care and the Democrats, I think that impacts on what he can do with Palestine. But we'll know in the next few days, because if there's no settlement freeze, that really completely destroys American credibility. And if there's no peace plan, because now we're beginning to... Obama was supposed to present a comprehensive peace plan next week. Now we're hearing that there is no peace plan. So if that's really the case, then we're really back to square one, which is conflict. And I think the Palestinians are going to start moving much more strongly towards a one-state solution.
Well, now there is a proposal. It's coming from Tel Aviv, and this was created by teams of Israeli and Palestinian negotiators and experts. And it's not clear to me if this will be embraced by the Obama administration. But it's a 400-page blueprint. It calls for, let me find it here. This came from Yossi Bailin, a former Israeli peace negotiator, and a guy named Gadi Baltiansky, who leads the Israeli team. It calls for...
the Geneva Initiative people.
Okay. This calls for...
Then that's not going to go anywhere.
It calls for a Palestinian state in 98% of the West Bank, all of Gaza, and the Arab-populated areas of Jerusalem. And it is described as going into minute detail... And the Palestinians appear to be neutral to disinterested in this proposal.
No, it's the old Geneva proposal, which gives the Palestinians territory, but Israel keeps a greater Jerusalem. Israel keeps control over the borders, over a lot of the airspace, over a lot of the water. In other words, it gives them a lot of territory, but it's more sterile territory. I think the Palestinians are simply saying, look, if you want a two-state solution, get out of the occupied territories. And let's not forget, the occupied territories are only 22% of historic Palestine. So that's not a completely unreasonable demand. And if you're going to start monkeying around like Yossi Bailin is and giving this and taking away that and keeping this piece of Jerusalem and that part of the border and this settlement, forget it. Either you're out and there's a two-state solution, or we're going to move towards a one-state solution. I think that's sort of the critical junction we're in today in terms of the Palestinian reaction.
Mm-hmm. And, Jeff, from your perspective, in addition to trying to get Nancy Pelosi to moderate her support for Israel, what else do you see as necessary from the United States to help broker some sort of a breakthrough here?
Well, I think there's a formula that I think is very clear that would be very effective. The United States has to say three things to Israel. First of all, we love you. Israel has to hear that, okay? We're not anti-Semitic. We love you. Fine. Two, we will absolutely guarantee your security. Whatever that means, you become a member of NATO, there'll be foreign troops in the West Bank for a few years. I mean, Israel really doesn't need that because it has such a superior army. The Palestinians aren't a threat. But the Israeli public has to hear that somehow the United States will guarantee Israel's security. And third, the occupation's over, period. You're out of every square inch of the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem, in a year, two, 3 years, however long it takes to redeploy. And if the United States would say that in an assertive way, just like de Klerk was told in South Africa, this is what you have to do, you would have Israeli public support for that, because the Israelis also don't want really the occupation. They never bought into the settlement. But that's the point. It's easy to get to a solution. The point is, can the Obama administration muster the clout in Congress that it's going to take to assert that kind of a formula? And if it can't, then we're back to haggling with Israel and this settlement and that settlement and 98% and 10%, and it'll go on forever. So it's really a matter of are the Americans going to cut this Gordian knot, or are they just going to keep haggling for the next 50 years?
Mm-hmm. And, Jeff, as we close here, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the recent activities of your group, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions?
Well, actually, I'm speaking to you right now from Torino, Italy, because we believe that the Israeli public is not taking the responsibility that it should, and that the Israeli people can live very well with the occupation. They'd like it to be over, but on the other hand, they can live. The Israeli economy is doing well. People are doing fine. There's no urgency. So we're traveling. I'll be in the States for all of October. I'll be the first week in October in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, as one of the Israeli peace organizations, we are working very hard in what we call international advocacy. We're meeting with members of parliament. We're meeting with members of Congress. We're meeting journalists, and certainly the thousands, literally, of organizations and church groups and trade unions that are getting involved in this issue, that people are beginning to see as the global issue. So I'm getting a lot of hope from that there's a groundswell. And I think it's true. When the people lead, the leaders follow. Obama and the different governments of the world are not going to lead us. They have to be pushed by us. And I really think, as I'm traveling around the world, that this issue really is assuming the proportions of the anti-apartheid struggle. So actually, I take heart in the fact that our work abroad seems to be bearing fruit.
Well, Jeff, let us know next time you're going to be in Northern California. I'd love to sit down and talk with you again.
I'll be there in February.
All right, sir. And thanks for the work that you're doing. It's great to talk to you today.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Jeff Halper from the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions here on the Peter B. Collins Show. The Mad as Hell Doctors are on the road, heading for Washington, D.C.
I'm out of crying, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again.
As we reported to you in August, a group of medical doctors from the Portland area are mad as hell. And they are driving RVs on a protracted tour from Portland to Washington, D.C., expecting to arrive toward the end of October. And their forces have been augmented by Dr. Margaret Flowers. And I'm delighted to bring her on the program today. Dr. Flowers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know just a little bit about you from your rap sheet, because you have been fighting for me and many other Americans to make single-payer, some people call it Medicare for all, an important aspect of this non-debate, this sideshow, this World Wrestling Federation mess, this mashup that has developed over the efforts to reform our health care system. And that has devolved to what I see as, unfortunately, a trivial effort to make some minor changes in the private health insurance regulations. Talk a little bit about your background as a medical doctor and why you have been so passionate about injecting your views and mine, too, into this debate.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I am a pediatrician. I practiced in the Baltimore area in Maryland, and I, like many of my colleagues, saw how it was getting harder and harder to provide quality health care in this environment. We're pushed to see more and more patients and spend less time with them, and none of the way our health situation is set up is geared towards really providing quality primary care, and so we're losing a lot of primary care doctors. And so I actually got involved in this and trying to figure out what's going on and learned about health care reform and looked at the health policy and realized, like many other, the majority of physicians, that a national health program that's financed publicly is the only solution that's universal and controls costs and allows patients to choose their doctors and doctors to practice again. So I left practice to do this full time and I've joined Physicians for National Health program and working with them and working with the members of Congress to try to get our voice heard in this debate, and that was a very difficult thing to do.
And isn't it frustrating that you're fighting for single payer and there are so many morons in this country who don't bother to understand what it is, what it means, and that it's not socialism and it's not a government takeover of the healthcare system?
That's correct. Well, we're up against so much misinformation, but we really think of a national health system as a civilized medicine because it's what civilized nations do for their people. It's a public good to create a healthy society so people can be productive. And a single-payer financing mechanism is the only way to control health care costs, which should appeal to those who are fiscally conservative. But it's what we see with the groups that are opposing health care reform is that they don't really understand the issue, like you said, and they don't really have a solution, which is unfortunate.
Well, and we did a program last week where we mapped out for our listeners the overlapping activist groups that are funded by corporate interests through lobbying shops in Washington, through phony nonprofits like Americans for Prosperity. And we really see how orchestrated this is. And let me get your honest thoughts. I won't try to impose mine on you, but tell me your thoughts about the way that the Obama administration and the Democratic leadership have handled this whole process starting in January.
Right. Well, it's been a big disappointment to us, really. And I'm also part of the coalition called the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare. And we had made a very simple request going into this session of Congress at this time of a healthcare debate that it be an actual debate, that it actually be about what is going to improve the quality of health in our nation and save lives and end the suffering that we see every day in our nation, and that our voice should be included at the table. And instead of allowing us to have that debate, what we saw was actions that I believe were derived from fear of failure from the 90s. And so they chose a position of compromise and scripted the whole debate to be geared towards achieving that end, which would be, a public-private partnership type thing with a public option, which is not good health policy from the get-go.
And the Wednesday night speech last week from President Obama, so many Democrats say he hit it out the park. It's a game changer. And what I saw was a president who was boxed in by the mob mentality generated from these corporate Fed groups. And he was on the defensive, explaining what it wasn't before he could explain what it is. There is no actual Obama health care plan. And so they have fumbled this in so many ways. They created this rich target. And during the August recess, the millions of dollars from corporate interests was used to fog up people's minds, to cloud the debate, to confuse people about things like death panels and socialized medicine and all this BS. And I really saw a president who was there once again negotiating with himself. And he gave up this watered-down idea of a public option. Sure, he said he favors it, but in the same breath, he said, I'm not going to fight for it. And then he tipped his hat toward tort reform, and I'm not entirely opposed to, you know, reevaluating some of those issues, but it's not a driver in terms of covering more people with health insurance. It's not a driver in significantly increasing costs, either at the, you know, distribution of health services level or at the insurance company level. It is a very minor sideshow, and here was the president trying to appease Republicans who will never, ever, ever vote for a Democratic health reform bill.
That's exactly true. And, you know, if we want real health reform in this country, it's going to be a struggle. We know that. We have a very wealthy, investor-owned private health industry, which is making a lot of money off of the current situation. They don't want to see that changed. But at the same time, we have thousands of people dying every year, people who can't get care, people are suffering, doctors that are leaving practice. So we have to make a choice. Are we going to continue to kind of kowtow to that industry and make overtures of reform that are really not effective? Or are we going to take the hard steps and go somewhere and create real health reform? And that is something the president can't do by himself, and we recognize that. And that's got to come from us. It's got to come from the people. And that's why, actually, I'm on the road with the Mad as Hell doctors, because we need to build this grassroots movement, this wave that will bring that energy forward into Washington so that we can create real change.
Now, Dr. Margaret Flowers, let me have your thoughts here at this moment, because I know many progressives who are at the point of either just giving up or withdrawing from this cycle of attempted health care reform. And I know some people who are saying, you know, there's so little left in these bills, and they're going to be carved up by the conservatives in the Senate. And we should mention that conservative Democrats are a big part of the problem here as well. But are we at the point where we ought to just trash this effort and figure that we've got to start over?
Well, trash what they're doing in Congress, yes, but not the effort. This is actually a huge time to push harder. We have a window here right now because we have legislation, H.R. 676, the National Health Care Act, which would create a national publicly financed system. And we are going to have a debate and a vote on that on the floor of the House. Speaker Pelosi agreed to let Representative Wiener offer a substitution amendment this fall. And so that can actually come in, possibly fill in that vacuum. So now is the time to push even harder for a real solution to our health care problem, a national public system. And so all those people who believed in single payer in the beginning and were told that it was not practical, that they should go for the public option, and we see that the public option is not going to happen, now is the time for us to really direct our energy towards and focus on H.R. 676 and getting that voted in, you know, on the House of Representatives.
Well, I've been a longtime supporter of the Conyers bill. I think it is the most sensible approach going forward. And I don't believe it would put the insurance companies out of business. It would give them some level of competition and give consumers a level of choice that we don't have. I was just listening to my friend Ed Schultz, and in North Dakota, Blue Cross controls 94% of the market. Now, you can't have competition under those circumstances, and unless we're going to go into trust-busting mode and break up these huge health insurance carriers, then the only way to inject competition is through a government coverage plan, not government delivery of services, but government management of the insurance aspect of it.
Well, it's Medicare for everybody, and if you ask senior citizens who have Medicare, they much prefer it. The polls show that they prefer that over private insurance. And if you ask physicians in terms of working with Medicare, billing them, their accuracy of billing, the fact that Medicare doesn't question our medical decisions, allows us to practice medicine, we favor it as well. The reimbursement is an issue, but that would change if we created Medicare for all, because we'd have all of our health care dollars going in to prop up Medicare and make it a real working system for everybody.
Yeah. And Dr. Flowers, where are the Mad as Hell doctors today, and how's your progress toward Washington?
Well, it's great. We arrived in Denver, Colorado, just a few minutes ago. We're getting ready to do a rally at the Capitol at noon Denver time. And then they're going to continue on across to Des Moines, Iowa. I'm going to leave from Denver and head back to Washington because there's a lot happening there over the next few weeks. And I'll be getting ready for their arrival in Washington, which will actually be September 30th. And we're holding a rally at Lafayette Park at 4 p.m. on September 30th. So we invite people to come and join us for that event.
All right. Well, Dr. Margaret Flowers, it's a real pleasure to talk with you. And again, I thank you for the sacrifices that you've made and the personal efforts that you have put into injecting realism and the interests of the majority of Americans. 70% support the concept of a single-payer approach. And we're being shunted aside by corporate interests and by Democrats who are compromising way too much. We need to fight and fight hard, and I appreciate what you've brought to this this struggle.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, for having me, and thank you for all that you're doing to educate people and give them the truth and honest information.
We're doing what we can. Dr. Margaret Flowers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and our broadcast, our podcast, is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer for you, the Peter B. Collins listeners. Coming up next, Gary Chu, our official film reviewer, will tell you about Matt Damon's new flick. But first, before we move on from Dr. Flowers and healthcare, I want to share with you some astounding numbers that have just been released by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Health Research and Educational Trust. They did a survey of more than 3,000 employers across the country this year. And it confirms the worst of our fears about the escalating costs in health insurance that aren't related to increases in the cost of living and are outpacing the ability of people to pay for them and for, you know, wages to catch up. The average annual premium this year rose by 5%, although I've heard anecdotal increases of 30%. Of Blue Cross consumers here in California. Over the last 10 years, your health premiums have risen 131%, while the average wages have gone up only 38%. That, of course, doesn't include healthcare CEOs. Now, inflation has gone up 28%, wages 38%. Let's do this again. Inflation 28%, wages 38%, and premiums 131%. The report found that if premiums to continue to increase by about 6.1% a year, which is the average of the last 5 years, that by 2019, a family of four will be paying $24,000 for health insurance. Now, this comes at a time when many employers are shedding their contributions to insurance and to copays. A decrease of 6% this year in the number of employers who offer health benefits went from 66 to 60%. Now, 8% of employers have said that they're somewhat or very likely to drop coverage, and more than 40% say that they plan to increase the amount that employees pay toward their premiums. So the shift continues from employer-paid health care to a tax on employees. That doesn't get called a tax. This year, the average individual will pay almost $5,000 for coverage, $13,000 for the average family. Over the last decade, worker contributions have increased by 128%. And employers generally pay about 74% of the cost of coverage. So when you look at these numbers, and then you look at the so-called health care reform coming out of Washington. There's nothing that I see in these bills that will actually reduce the rate of increase in the cost of health care insurance. I don't see any way of reining that in based on the legislation so far. And the only hope is a single-payer approach, which seems completely unattainable politically, or this watered-down public option concept, which, if it were implemented, would, appear to have some effect in competing with the for-profit insurers and causing them to think twice about continuing this escalation of prices to consumers. It underscores the greed of the healthcare industry and how those costs have gone up. And if we lopped out the for-profit insurance companies, 28% of the cost would go away right away. But that's not even on the table in Washington, where President Obama assured that joint session of Congress that he's not going to put any insurance companies out of business. We'll continue to cover these issues here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And finally, on this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, we're joined by Gary Chu, our official PBC movie reviewer. He's based in Sacramento. Gary, how are you today?
I'm just fine, Peter B. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Matt Damon is a guy who really impresses me both on screen and off. When I've seen him appear with Bill Maher and on some other political talk shows, he's a very sharp, knowledgeable guy, progressive, and he belies a lot of those Hollywood airheads. It's really neat to see. And you've had a chance to see his new film, The Informant, which is opening wide this weekend.
That's true, and I agree with you, Peter B. Matt is what I've seen of him, other than when he's on screen, is impressive, too. And also, what's really nice about it, he's really a fine actor, and he really carries this film as well.
Mm-hmm. So, now, let's talk about the director first. You're a pretty big fan of Steven Soderbergh.
Well, to a certain degree. Not everything of his I like, but I do like this film, The Informant. And the thing I like about Soderbergh is that he stays on the cutting edge pretty much of what he does and with films and who he associates with, actors and other directors and producers. But although I don't like everything he does, there's always something kind of different and, as I said, cutting edge about what he's doing. And The Informant is kind of falls into that category.
Mm-hmm. And his recent political films have included Syriana and Michael Clayton. And I thought both of those were interesting and a little different. They weren't your, kind of typical agitprop or political pick of the era.
Exactly. Now, the new film, The Informant, is a little bit like a couple of other films, though, in some ways. If you recall back into the late 90s, the making of the film The Insider, the tobacco thing with Al Pacino and
it was based on the 60 Minutes story, and it was the guy from Kentucky who blew the whistle on tobacco right. companies who were spiking nicotine levels while denying that they did that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You got it. You're the encyclopedia. The Insider was an excellent film, and also the other film that it's sort of like is A Beautiful Mind. The schizophrenia and the college professor, Russell Crowe, was also in that one.
Sure.
And the reason these two films are sort of alike is, the Informant is like them because they have to do with whistleblowing, and that's The Insider, of course. And then A Beautiful Mind brings in a mental issue, which also the lead in the film that Damon plays, his name is Mark Whitaker, is a real man. He works for Archer Daniel Midland Company. He did
oh, yeah.
time.
They're the wonderful people who brought us ethanol and get huge federal subsidies for that fuel, which really hasn't proven to be that practical or efficient.
Yes, and that's the story is wrapped around them. I noticed by Archer Daniel Midland Company actually has got a website up now. I haven't looked at it that closely. I just went by it, but it's their PR take on this film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, they invited the crew into, I think they're located in Southern Illinois, the headquarters are.
Yeah, they are.
Mm-hmm. And so they brought the cast and the crew in and made nice with them and everything like this, but the film is actually sort of pejorative, not sort of, but is pejorative of ADM, but Soderbergh making it a different kind of film. It's a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's light, and it's supposed to entertain you. And after a while, you find out that Matt Damon's character also has bipolar difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
So he is lying like crazy all through the film. He's also the informant to the FBI on price fixing for the amino acid lysine that the ADM manufactures, and they're price fixing with major agribusiness companies around the world for this.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's involved with that, and he's also involved he's actually embezzling around $9 million throughout the film from the company.
Oh,
he's a real nice guy. He's a very nice guy.
Then he's working a lot of angles. He's blowing the whistle, he's doing his job, and he's fleecing the company for $9 million all at the same time?
Yes. And to make it even funnier, Tom and Dick Smothers have cameos in it. Dick Smothers plays a judge, and Tom Smothers plays one of the ADM high-up officials,
mm-hmm.
or rather executives. The guy from the TV show The Soup on cable, Joel McHale, is an FBI agent, never cracks a smile.
Hmm.
Another guy you've probably seen on Bill Maher and other shows on TV and cable, Paul F. Tompkins, sort of a deadpan comic. He's also on the Overman show on MSNBC. He plays an FBI agent in it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is they're loading the cast with these people who are really funny people, but they're not playing funny roles.
Hmm.
They're playing serious people, and here you've got Matt Damon doing all this stuff, going around in circles, doing all of these weird things, and doing an excellent job of it. And the script is written in such a way where you just kind of you're having light chuckles all the way through the film as you see this this story that's based on something that really happened. Actually, the book is called The Informant,
mm-hmm.
and was written by Kurt Eichenwald, I think it was.
Hmm. Now, you know, Tommy and Dick Smothers are pretty active in Northern California. I think it's Tommy who owns the Volvo dealership in the Napa County area.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find them. I've run into them at benefit concerts and celebrity golf tournaments, that kind of thing. And they're both very approachable.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy, in particular, is an interesting guy. He, you know, he's aware of his quirky public persona,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of enjoys playing it a little bit and then kind of undermining it at the same time to show you that he's a real guy.
Yeah. After watching him on television so much through the years, you know, when they were so big on CBS and had the big brouhaha with CBS,
mm-hmm.
I've become quite a fan of Tommy's myself. And so what's so funny about the film, Peter B., is that he comes in in one scene with about four or five other executives into this sort of a confrontational office thing with Matt Damon. And it took me about three or four minutes to realize who the heck he was, because, you know, he's not so young anymore. In fact, I'm about his age. And I looked at him and I realized, well, that's Tommy Smothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pick up these things about the film is really trying to entertain you while giving you a story. And what you take away from this film actually is that there's an actual quote in the film that is taken from trial records in the proceedings that are attached to the true story, and the quote goes something like, the competitors are our friends, the customers are our enemies.
Mm.
Now, that doesn't sound like a free market to me. So, you know, that's it. The I mean, George Clooney, who is one of the producers, along with Soderbergh and Matt Damon, as you said, is an astute, interesting, talented actor. These guys have an agenda with this film, obviously, and it's an agenda that I think is another way of getting some entertainment out to some people that may not be quite aware of what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they make some allusions to high fructose corn syrup, and also, which is also, as you know, a big deal with agribusiness.
Sure.
We're inundated with that,
and
I try to avoid it almost everything in everything I ingest into myself these days.
You bet. It's one of the biggest causes of obesity in America.
I know it.
Mm-hmm.
I know it. So it's a good film, and I think you'll like it, and I think people who follow your show will enjoy watching it. It's a very well-made film, and Marvin Hamlisch does the music.
Mm-hmm.
Arranging of the music, and we're both into music, and his music is excellent, and it really adds a nice little comedic touch to all of the scenes that need it, suppose you could say.
All right, well, Gary, it sounds like you're recommending this flick. I'm going to go check it out as soon as I can find it on a big screen near me.
And it will be near you on Friday.
We're
supposed to use days.
Oh, yeah, it's okay. our podcast listeners will figure it out.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Gary, and we will see you at the movies.
Okay.
Gary Chu, here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening to this episode. Drop me an email with your points of contention, or even if you agree. Peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until